Good evening. I'm Rabbi Eli Bacon, one of the Eskam Mashkichim here at Yeshiva University. And before we get started, I just really want to give the appropriate thank yous to the people who worked to put this together, without whom we wouldn't be here tonight to discuss this important topic. So first and foremost, can everyone hear me? So first and foremost, the co-chair people of the Academic Honesty Committee, we have Samantha Selesny, Mona Shizagi. Two of them work very hard in all areas of honesty within the university life. So tonight, we'll be focusing on one aspect of honesty in terms of dating and relationships, but they hope to have future events that will address other areas of honesty, both in the business world and other such things. So really a big thank you to them for putting this together. They partnered together tonight with the YU Connects, Rebbetzin Dr. Efrat Sadalovsky and her YU Connects team and staff worked hard to put this together. And of course the other sponsors, the student councils, both uptown here and downtown at Stern College for Women, who sponsored this event. Tonight we are discussing the Mida, the character trait of honesty, of NS, the being a truthful person, and its relationship to the building of positive, healthy relationships in the dating process. Now obviously this Mida of NS is something that runs very deep within our roots as a Jewish people. We know that our Avos, our forefathers, were described as people who were Yesharim. They were upright, they were truthful, they were straightforward. Yaakov Avinu was very known and praised as being an Ish Emes. And of course, our kind of contrast arch-rival Esav was known as a person who was an Ish Yodei Tzayin, a person who was conniving, who was tricky, and who was dishonest. So our calling is clear. We are supposed to kind of nurture and cultivate this Mida of honesty. And yet, I think many of us find ourselves torn with exactly in the dating process, in the building of relationship process, of how does this idea of honesty play out within that process. And that can range for a whole host of reasons, whether it be about discussing our own family histories, medical histories, psychological histories, just our upbringing, what do we say, when do we say, what don't we say. It could relate to what we talk about with our friends and who we've been dating. It could relate to family that is bugging us for information and what do we share with them. So there's a whole host of areas that this idea of honesty and what we should and should not be sharing with people becomes very important. So thank God we are very fortunate to have in our university people who really can give us guidance, who have a wealth of information and experience, and are willing to come and share that with us tonight. So I have the pleasure of introducing two people that really need no introduction. Rabbi Willick, who's a Rosh Hashiva here, Dr. Pelkovitz, who is a professor at the Azrieli School and also special assistant to the president. And both of them have such a tremendous wealth of experience and knowledge that Baruch Hashem, we are privileged for them to join us tonight. The way I'd like things to work is I'm going to ask both Rabbi Willig and Dr. Pelkovitz to present each for 10 minutes, maybe an overview, both from a Torah perspective, from a psychological perspective about this topic. And while they're doing that, I implore all of you to think of questions, things that come to mind. There should be note cards that are around, and people should feel free to write their questions down. We will collect it after the presentations. And then after the presentations, we'll try to deal specifically with the questions that you had in mind. So without further ado, I'd like to call Rabbi Willig to speak.
I'll call Dr. Pelkovitz to speak first.
And now we've switched.
You could all sit down. It's my fault. I forgot.
It's okay.
I'll be the warm-up here. Okay. I was going to focus, first of all, let me thank Dr. Sadalovsky for organizing this and for Mary Bacon as well in terms of providing the questions that are going to organize both of our remarks. I'm going to focus on three main points. And in terms of honesty, I've been very intrigued lately by a whole new body of research that's coming out in a field called behavioral ethics, where they show that there's two neurologic systems that guide us when we're deciding to be honest. So one is the cognitive system, where we put our shalrosh on every morning, the men here, prefrontal, frontal cortex, where we, most of us know how important it is to be honest. Most of us know the basic guidelines about being decent, moral, ethical human beings. But it turns out that what we're discovering now is that bishas masa, when you're in the heat of the moment, a whole different system takes over, the research is showing. And very often, the part of us that knows better at that point of that mukuda sabuchir, or that point of choice, sort of like is more likely to have what serves our more emotional needs best take over. And the antidote is to think about it ahead of time. That's why it's so important what these series of lectures are about, because to the extent that we can really clarify where we stand, or as Viktor Frankl said beautifully, he said, between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space lies our growth. In that space lies basically our choices. But if you don't think about it, and bring it to your emotional self, which is certainly what's taking over in the early stages of dating, it's very hard to do what's right and what's ethical. Three points I wanted to focus on briefly, guided by the set of questions. Number one is TMI, too much information. I'll just read to you the questions, which are all terrific, all coming from real life experiences that have come up here. Okay? So it's a set of questions that go like this. When is sharing too much information? When you share certain medical or psychological conditions, either yours or a family member's, how much of anything do you share about earlier relationships? How do you share about your relationships with your siblings, parents, difficult familial issue, or other kinds of issues like that? There, we're going to hear the halakhic guidelines in a few minutes, and common sense would say that no matter what, you're not going to come up with everything about yourself right at the beginning. That would happen, it just wouldn't nourish a normal, healthy kind of relationship. There is the time, guided by halacha and guided also by good psychology, when that's ideal for when to share. At a certain point in a relationship, you know you're moving on to the next stage, and that's when healthy disclosure is not only called for, but it becomes the building block of relationships. Let me just share with you what an excellent review in a psychology journal a few years ago said about the power of disclosure once you're ready for it. It says the following. It says that as we open up to people about the real issues, about our real selves, as we open up to people about the realities of our family, because every family and every life has certain issues going on that we don't necessarily feel comfortably talking about early on. Here's the three things that the research shows. People who disclose more are liked by others more. Number two, people disclose more to those they like. And number three, after people disclose to others, they like those people more than before. So it's a very interesting set of research. What they're finding is that when you're ready to do it, it will actually, ideally, if the relationship is meant to be, it will build and nourish the relationship. And if it doesn't, if the response is one of horror, or one of rejection, or one of lack of comfort, then, you know, I don't know, you should bench Gomel, or we should say Baruch Hashem, okay, we're not meant for each other, and you move on. But if it cements the relationship, which it often does, then it's just a matter of timing. When's the right time to do it? So it's not the question of whether to disclose, but when to disclose, because secrecy is not good. And I'll share with you a brief story and then go on to the final 2 points. You know I can't control myself. Okay? So it's a brief story. Since I was seeing a guy for quite some time who was struggling with an anxiety disorder. And he'd been on medication, and he'd been doing much better. And he went off medication. And he was hitting a point that he was going out with somebody very seriously, and he wanted permission to not tell her about the history of medication. He wanted to just sort of present himself as having been perfect all the way through. And he realized, though, there was a Shiloh, okay? So he asked me to call Rav David Cohn, who was his family's posting. So I called Rav David Cohn, and I told him, and he, who actually knew this young man, and he said, listen, Pelman, he said, this, I'm not going to even allow it to be a Shiloh. He said, I could give you a psak on this. He said, but I just want to turn to you. He said, from a psychological standpoint, knowing how important it was to this life of this young man to conquer his anxiety, and knowing how central that is to his narrative of his life, do you think it would be healthy for him to go into a marriage without his wife knowing one of the basic building blocks of his personality? So he said, you decide, okay? And of course, I went back to the boy, and I told him what Rav David had said. And that Rav David had actually said, among other things, that he should also open up to her that he'd been on medication, he had overcome it, and now that he was fine. He was extremely upset. He didn't want to do it, and he got extremely angry at me and Rav David. But ultimately, he told her. And what ended up happening is she said, so what's your point? You know, like, of course, that's wonderful. I'm so proud of you that you did that. What's so interesting is that now, many years later, I get calls from him on a pretty regular basis, but it's about his wife, who has a real struggle with anxiety herself, okay? It didn't become obvious till after they married. And his anxiety is fine now. But the fact is that being open to her made him extremely helpful to her, and that's a very common kind of outcome that you find. So that's point one. Point two and point three, just as quickly as I can, is I wanted to talk about, and this is, I think, a very important point. I was discussing it a little bit earlier with Rabbi Willig, and it's the idea that how do you talk about, in an honest way, about your concerns in a relationship? Let's say you don't find the other person attractive enough yet. Everything else is fine, but you're having a little some doubts about the physical attraction. Or let's say you're having some doubts about how intellectually compatible you are because you feel that they're a little beneath you intellectually. And the question is, how honest should you be about that? And here I'm going to say something that's obvious and extremely important, okay? And that's, there's a huge difference between criticism and constructive feedback. Criticism. Actually say to somebody, chas v'shalom, to say to somebody, I really don't find you attractive, is a horrible thing to do. You just don't do that. That destroys the essence of the person. And if you end up together, it's something that will probably haunt them for the rest of their marriage. And the same thing about anything that would be. Now, you may say in a different way, you could talk about these things in a way that gives constructive feedback. So let's say you're finding that the person isn't intellectually challenging enough, so you could talk about, you know, I find it very interesting at times to talk about A, B, and C. It would be great for me if we could, if maybe you read this book and that book and we could talk about it a little bit. The research shows that a key building block of a successful relationship is something that is called self-expansion. Where in relationships, you grow through each other, you complete each other, and you learn. I've learned a tremendous amount from my wife over the years, and she developed a side of me that was never developed before that. And when I hear about her experiences at work, I grow from it tremendously, and vice versa. Okay? That kind of self-expansion is terrific, and she has assets that I don't have, and maybe the other way around. But the key is how you approach it, and how to approach it in a kind way, in an honest way, but in a way that's always asking, is this going to be hurtful, or is it going to promote self-expansion? And the final point I want to make about honesty is if you hear something about the person that you didn't know before, or even earlier on, is consider reconsidering. A lot of us go into relationships, we have a list. I'll never date somebody who's a child of divorce. I'll never date somebody who has a history of having taken medication. I'll never do this, I'll never do that. We have lists. And I can't emphasize enough how off that might be. You know, the research shows that it's true. Children of divorce may have a somewhat marginally greater chance of having some baggage that will show itself in marriage. But also the research shows and experience shows that they value shalom bayis so much that often they make unbelievably remarkable spouses because they appreciate the power of shalom bayis because they experience such pain as a result of not having shalom bayis. And it's the same thing with a lot of the other issues that we often say, no, I can't handle this, I can't handle that. Be open to the possibility that somebody who's going through a tough time in their life, that that's a source of growth. To end with the beautiful thoughts of the Medrash Tehillim, Ilu nafalti lo kamti, ilu yashavti b'choshech lo hayarli. It's through the process of falling down that you get up, through the process of sitting in darkness that you appreciate the light, and to end up spending your life with somebody who's had that engine of growth is something that we should seriously consider as well. So I'll hand it over to Father Willard. Thank you. Nice.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Dr. Slavolovsky, Dr. Bacon, ladies and gentlemen. My remarks will also be brief. And I will also speak about what you shouldn't be saying based upon the questions that are here in front of me. How much, if anything, do you share about your earlier relationships? The ideal? Nothing. Nothing. Comparisons are odious. You approach a young man, a young woman, with a clean slate. You don't discuss anything about what came before. Continue. Further. How much do you share, if anything at all, with others about the people you are dating, even if they are persistent in asking to consider you their best friends? Answer again, nothing. Nothing. This is lashon hara. He said, I went out with this one and this one, and she's no good and he's no good and this one. Nobody's business. If you have an issue which you want to discuss with someone, whether the relationship is appropriate for you, there are others to discuss it with. Parents, your rabbis, your teachers, your specialists, to hack in the dorm, all hours of the night, about I just came back from this day, this was terrible. Why? Just the answer again, nothing. And finally, the third point that the thought was to care, how do we part from a relationship? To spot everything we're not sure of, we're not happy with? If the answer again is no. No. Not working out. There's no need to hurt somebody any more than necessary. So after these three nothings, for the questions which are found in the list of questions. The first question, when do you share a certain a medical or psychological conditions, yours or a family member, etc.? This is a serious question. As a matter of fact, for the boys of Mashiach over here, we spent about 2 weeks talking about this at the very beginning of Masechta Yevamos. That may sound strange. What does it do with Masechta Yevamos? For those who look between the lines, it's right there. The very beginning, the base, I'm sure most boys got that far by now. The discussion there twice also talks about a combination issue called Kiddushei Tos, a marriage under false pretenses, which may even be invalid. And even if it doesn't rise to that level, it's still considered to be fooling someone, which is no, as you're not telling the whole truth, which is inappropriate. Counterbalancing to this is a famous piece of the Kilos Yaakov of the Stipler, the great Gadol of Bnei Brak, which is based on another Gemara Masechta Yevamos that is much later on in that Mem Hei, about an individual who stems from a mixed marriage, a non-Jewish father and a Jewish mother, who was halachically Jewish, but no one wanted to marry him because of his lack of pedigree. And the Amoraim told him to go somewhere no one knows who you are, go hide, and get married there. And the Kilos Yaakov, the stipler, asked an obvious question. How are you allowed to hide this? Do you want to sell a car, a house? Are you allowed to hide the defects? His answer is very penetrating. His answer is, we're discussing objects, cars, houses, etc. There are many, many identical objects in the world. You have the right to sell your car without divulging some defect when the same person could buy the same car for the same price without a defect. If you have the right to fool him, and if it rises to a little bit of a higher level, it's already considered what we call in Hebrew a mekach tos, a sale under false pretenses, is invalidated. However, when it comes to human relationships, this is simply not true. Because if a boy meets a girl or vice versa, you cannot find the identical young man or young woman exactly the same with all the good things, but just lacking that one defect. That person doesn't exist. Doesn't exist. So you're not required to tell your prospective spouse whom you're dating about the growth on your big toe that's been hit by your shoes on the ground, that what I would have to tell if it was a shoe in a car and in a house, because they can't find a young man like you or a young woman like you with all the great things about yourself without that growth in the big toe. Can't. They can find a car without that scratch in the bottom, or a house without that leak in the roof. You name it. This is the idea which is found in the Sefer Chilos. How exactly you apply it, of course, is a matter of great, great complexity. That's what we spend so much time on. There's even a Sefer which is in the library which is about this, called Binas HaShidduch, I believe it is. A rabbi in Eretz Yisrael goes into great details about what must be divulged and when. The general principle, as we heard earlier, is that most things which are not obvious on the first date should not be divulged in advance. If something is obvious and it's just going to lead to a whole problem on the initial date, I think it should be revealed in advance. Most things are not obvious, and therefore they should not be revealed on the first date. Let's see. You don't have to spill your guts to everybody. You know, in one system in Yerushalayim, I'll catch this now, think for a second carefully about this. When a boy meets a girl, the first date, hold on tight, they don't look at each other. How much? They meet in the living room, he faces this way, and she faces this way. They don't look at each other. But they fell, watched this man have the pictures of so many beautiful women in his head before he gets married. He met this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. It just doesn't make sense. So therefore, they'll talk. They'll catch it quick. But they won't officially look at each other. And if it goes, well, okay. Okay, say, I like this girl, I like this boy. Okay, next time, let's sit opposite a table and look at each other. That's a little extreme. I don't advocate it in our world. Well, in principle, it sounds good, but don't do it. Don't even try it, please. But the principle does apply to, you know, problems. The person that we've ever had medical problems, psychological problems, whatever you have, tell everybody on the first date. Doesn't even make sense. Of course, the question becomes, so then when do you do it? So as a general principle, my view has always been, you try to do it at about the halfway point. We spoke about this in the past. What is the halfway point? It's like a radioactive half-life. You never know in advance what's the halfway point. But given the world that you inhabit, you can sort of have a guess. You know, in certain circles, where they go out a total of four times, so after 2 days, you pass the halfway point. And they go out for 4 months, after 2 months, you pass the halfway point. So you have to know yourself and your friends and what gives in your part of the world to know an approximation of when this point has arrived. There are disputes, significant disputes, among the great poskim about what can be kept a secret. Feinstein and Igris Moshe has a remarkable chidush of what can be kept secret, even if they're medical in nature. And yet other things, these things must be revealed. I remember Rav Soloveitchik felt somewhat differently on these matters. Rabbi Yashim has weighed in disagreement with some of the things that his Bechut and the Stipler said on what must be revealed, what need not be revealed. This is not the time or the forum to go into the details. There's a voice of Mashiach. They have to study for Bechinah soon. They have to start reviewing it, so they have to know it. You can ask them. You can try and get them why you taught her also. It's a couple of weeks of Shia at the beginning of this year. I'd like to close by saying that yes, honesty is a very, very important meter, as we heard. Very important. Nonetheless, particularly in the area of Shalom Bayis, we are taught again in the Gemara Nevam, that's Abba Sefta, that it's permissible to say something different than the truth. And according to the gears of the Rif, now is it permissible, but there's even a mitzvah. And where does it come from? It comes from a parasha we read a couple of weeks ago. Parasha is a parasha of Vayera, and it describes a conversation between Avram, Sarah, the Malachim, and Hashem. And Hashem says to Avram Avinu, why did Sarah say, Vaniv Zakanti, that I am old? What she really said is my husband is old. Whoa, big difference. So if Hashem was able to say something which is not exactly accurate, certainly so can and even must we. You'll ask, what happened to Emes? What happened to truth? The answer is that truth is a very, very important meaning. Chosamo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Emes. That's a stamp. That's a default position. It's the absolute truth. But some truths are so hurtful and can damage a marriage that they're better off being moved a little bit. And it's permissible and even mandatory in certain contexts. And one of the contexts is establishing and maintaining shalom bayis. You have to be careful. There are distinctions between someone who's just dating and someone who's already married. But once you're married, the idea of maintaining the shalom bayis, even at the expense of the absolute truth, exists for many, many years. Many years. Not only is it not saying everything that is true, but also in taking opportunities to make the marriage work better. The angels asked Avram, where is Sarah your wife? And he said, Ba'ohel Tsunuahi, she's a modest woman. And Chazal commented that the angels knew where Sarah was, but they asked the question, Kedei Lechavava Al-Bala, to make Sarah more beloved to her husband. Now how many years were they married at that time? Well, they know how old they were at that time. Sarah was 89 and Avram was 99. Okay. They weren't youngsters, they weren't teenagers. How long were they married? So someone just showed me in an Avar Benel in the parasha we just read, the parasha's told us, and earlier as well, just as Yitzhak married at 40, so too did Avram get married at 40. Now he's 99. Do the math. He's been married for 59 years. You still have to be careful of what you say. You don't want to hurt the marriage. You're supposed to create scenarios to make the marriage better. Give you all a bracha after 59 years of happy marriage, should still be making the marriage better.
Thank you both to Rabbi Willick, Dr. Palkovitz. If people took the opportunity to write questions down on the cards, maybe we could just pass them over to the aisles. You'll collect, or Danish will do some collecting. And we can also take some questions from the floor, but let's start with some of the cards if you can start passing them on. Yes, in the meantime, while we're waiting, does anyone want to raise their hand with a question? They're happy to take it.
Questions about your roommates.
So this is a question to both Rabbi Willick and Dr. Palkovitz. Is there a difference in information that needs to be disclosed once the age of the prospective matches changes, or do the rules you outlined stay the same throughout dating career or whatever point that reaches?
I do not want to be guilty of ageism. It's all the same.
What's let me hear what's behind the question.
Meaning, do we say that the same guidelines that exist for a 22-year-old go on to 23, 24, etc., or do we say, let's say, if a person is 30, then there are different guidelines?
Now, guidelines in terms of the 50% guideline, or guidelines in terms of, I'm not sure I understand how this would play out. How would a 30-year-old, give me a hypothetical of how it would play out differently.
Whatever rules were given this evening, would they be absolute rules throughout the career?
Look, honesty to me would be irrespective of the age of the person dating. I think each of the issues that we talked about, really, I'm not sure why it would be developmental. I hear that there might be, obviously, a 30-year-old dating is in a very different place than a 21 or 22-year-old dating, but I would think in terms of the underlying principles, I think should be the same. Because the process, I think the underlying process is essentially age independent.
A question here is, this is a disclosure question. If one knows about a parent of a particular individual who caused a very serious break in the family, and now this individual, these parents have another child who's just got engaged to somebody else, there's an obligation to warn the future family about the whole situation. It's a very good question. It would be nice if this would be known earlier. What we disclose is certainly dependent upon what stage of the relationship is at. One issue to be concerned with is, will the people listen to you? These are questions which are discussed in the Sefer Chofetz Chaim, by the Chofetz Chaim and Shmiras HaLashon as well. You don't disclose things if it's going to have no effect. In other words, once they got engaged, if they're going to remain engaged, notwithstanding the knowledge that in a different situation, the future mechutanim caused a dispute in the family, then why bother telling them? Hope for the best. But if you think that they may actually break it up or take certain precautions, maybe make sure to sign a prenup, things of this nature, then you could say something, but approach it gingerly since they're already engaged.
Okay. There's a question here about revealing about previous relationships. Doesn't it sometimes help to know someone's dating pattern? Meaning you may see yourself hurt if someone is honest with you. I'm sorry, you may save yourself hurt if someone is honest with you. Look, I think that before going out, I imagine that everybody, you know, there is a certain amount of homework that takes place to know if this is somebody who is a serial dater, who might have some commitment problems, etc. But once you're going out, first of all, it's what's I guess implied in this is that somehow you could protect yourself from that. I think you need to do your due diligence ahead of time if that's available to you. I would hope that once you're at a point of really revealing your inner self to somebody, you could talk about your previous patterns and some difficulties you might have had. But not necessarily at the beginning, because you may be the person who that pattern does not repeat with. And you may be sort of, there may be a different alchemy with you, there may be a different chemistry with you that would not repeat it. So I think that honesty eventually makes sense about it, but I think you have to give it some chance to unfold. And of course, there's always a risk. You know, we can't save ourselves from her. But what I would suggest is if you hear about somebody who has a pattern ahead of time, you have to decide if you want to risk getting involved with that person. And that's probably going to be something that you'll know about, you know, that as you do your homework ahead of time.
My next question is about potentially damaging information about someone. Examples are given: eating disorders or drug addiction. May or must you inform the person dating the person in question? They're very, very serious. These are where it gets very serious, in these detailed questions. I already said to you earlier that I think that these kinds of issues should be divulged by the person, him or herself, at a certain point in the relationship. If you, as an onlooker or an observer, are going to say something before that time, you may be removing any chance that this relationship can go places. But if you feel, you see that people are going out for a while already, and in your observer status from the outside, you think this is already going far along, maybe more than, quote, halfway along, and you still, from the best of your knowledge, think it hasn't been revealed, you can say something directly or indirectly perhaps through a rabbinical intermediary, which is always healthier than having a younger person say something. You don't have the experience and the precise terms to utilize. You can inform somebody who is better qualified to say something. You know, something may have happened. Perhaps you should be aware of it. Do your homework about it.
at the right time and in the right way. So you have to be very careful not to shoot from the hip.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. These are excellent. These are all excellent questions. This question is, what's the most appropriate way to disclose family problems? And what I'd say is, when you're up to that point of emotional intimacy that you could really talk about families, I used to have a professor who would say, there are two kinds of people. There are normal people and people I know. Okay? And that kind of captures that truth. I think the key there is when you're ready and you're really trusting the other person, to just be honest, to be honest about what the experience is. Because the fact that you may have a family member who has serious problems, to me, that's not only an important thing to share, but if you're dating somebody who says, you know, I really have a problematic relationship with a brother or with a sister or with a parent, the key for you as the person on the other side isn't whether or not they have a problem with that person, but it's how they deal with it, how they grow from it, and how they want it to be different in as they start their own family. That's the key. So the key is just honesty. I can't put the words in your mouth of how to say it, but to talk about it, to talk about the experience, and to talk about what you learn from the experience and how your hopes are that it'll be different for you. Because I see the norm is that as long as you have a recognition that you have a problem with somebody and you're willing to work on overcoming that, that's almost always what happens. When people put that front and center in their mattering map in terms of their goals of where they want to go. Where it becomes a problem is if they have a mother, father, or sibling who's a serious problem, they don't recognize it. Then they're probably more likely to be doomed to, in some ways, have it have an impact on them and maybe to repeat it.
Okay, I have two difficult questions, which I'll proceed to answer.
I'm sorry, right, is that tied to this question?
Yeah,
is it okay?
Point,
so again, to go back to what I started with, the disclosure will probably cement the attachment if it's the right person. The point to do it is at the point that you feel that you trust this person, the point that you feel that, let's say you're going to break up with him afterwards, that he's not, that you really trust him to keep it to keep it to himself and to not then ever use it against you. The 50% mark is probably not a bad mark psychologically either. The problem is I know it's very hard to know where that 50% mark is in our world, but I think the point is a point of, it's an inner voice say, where your heart is telling you, you know, I can really trust this guy. No.
Back to my two tough questions. First, I'm going to read it verbatim. What if a frum boy on a date tells or hints to you that he wants you to look more physically pleasing, example, wearing tighter, but parentheses, but sniut clothes. Should you stop dating him? Is this not a frum thing for him to point out? The answer is clear. Stop dating him. It's not a frum thing. And tighter, by definition, is not sniut. So put this away. The next question is much harder, but it's also very, very difficult. Is there a permissible double standard, and the double standard means between guys and girls, different standards, when it comes to asking about previous intimate relations, especially among Baal Tshuvas? This is a very hard question to answer. I'll do my best. Oh, you gave it to me. Thank you. We're good friends. He gives me. There's no double standard. There's no double standard. I believe that these issues are serious, very serious, but have to be dealt with very, very sensitively. When you use the word Baal Tshuva, it clearly depends upon what stage in life the individual became a Baal or Baalas Tshuva. In other words, let me put it to you as bluntly as I can. If someone, boy or girl, has gone through a non
Orthodox, not, but they're not observant, has gone through 4 years on a university campus when they're completely not observant, it's assumed that they've been sexually active. Percentage-wise, the percentage is so, it approximates 100%. So you just don't talk about it. Just, what we call it, don't ask, don't tell. Don't talk about it. It's assumed. On the other hand, if the person became a Baal Tshuva, a Baal Tshuva at a younger age, now probably before 10, I don't know what disease in the world we live in, and it's assumed in the other direction. And in between, in those 10 years in between, it depends exactly who, exactly when, exactly where. Now, if a person is what they call an FFB, frum from birth, so there is an assumption, I think it's a proper assumption, we call it in our language cheskas kashrus, a presumption of innocence and of conducting oneself properly and appropriately. And if either the boy or the girl has not done so, it seems to me that it's unfair to present oneself as a righteous individual from birth when it hasn't been the case. Now here's where the double standard comes in based upon the Gemara. The Gemara says that if a man marries a woman thinking she's a virgin, a pasula, and she's not, there's a whole question of it's called a toast, it's a mistake. This biological distinction clearly does not apply to a man, so that's where there may be certain distinctions along those lines. But fundamentally and conceptually, I believe that you have to be very careful in not hiding things for a whole variety of reasons, especially since if this line has been crossed of actual intimate relations, there could be problems down the road. Short of that, and there are many individuals who have not kept what we call today negiyah in their youth, that is something which, as I said before, you're not required to say anything about. That's what's called chatas ne'urim, the sins of youth. And we say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we said it in Slicha so many times, chatas nureinu v'sheinu v'altisko. We ask Hashem not to remember our youthful indiscretions. For this reason, I believe that there's ample room to be silent about these indiscretions, provided it didn't rise to the level that's described in this question. Okay. What if someone is a Kohen? A Kohanim, as you probably are aware, are not permitted to marry a woman who has lived with a non-Jewish man. So it's clearly, if she lived with a non-Jewish man, then she should not be dating Kohanim. That should be obvious to anybody. That's again a Masechta Yevamos. That's what we're learning this year. So clearly, that's a deal breaker. You don't even get started. That's obvious. I'm finished.
Oh, okay. Okay. Here's another complicated question. Someone has demonstrated psychologically problematic behaviors, such as emotional neediness or controlling tendencies in multiple relationships, is one obligated to reveal this if someone you know is dating that person, if I'm reading the handwriting correctly? Another complicated question. I think that to a certain extent it's a halakhic question, but from a psychological standpoint, the question is somebody who's controlling in one relationship by definition going to be controlling in all relationships? And I would say not necessarily. In other words, it's possible that there's a dynamic, where I've just seen it. I, to the extent that I spent a big chunk of my career working in, among others, with family violence and domestic violence, you sometimes would see situations where you have somebody who's just controlling because of the way personalities mesh, And it's not necessarily the case when there's another dynamic. I think that if l'chachilo, somebody's asking you, should I go out with this person? What was it like when you dated him or you dated her? Then I think an honest answer about how you experienced it. But it doesn't mean, we're not going to say that everybody who was controlling in one relationship should never be allowed to marry. First of all, it could change. I've seen people change. If they want to change, it's not easy to change, but both neediness, being controlling and manipulative, with somebody who wants to work on it, they can work on it. And they may not be as likely to show it when the dynamics are differently. So the halacha component of that is that are there issues there of either lifnayiver or of really a duty to warn?
It's clearly these can be very seriously problematic. Those who have dealt with marriage that are dysfunctional because of these neediness, I don't know too well, but controlling, I do know. That's a disaster for a marriage. If either party wants to control the marriage, it means they're not equals. One party wants to be in control and the other party should be subservient. That is not a marriage. And don't tell me, but you've seen it in so many times. It's true. You've seen it. We've all seen it. It's not a proper marriage. If you know someone, and I confess being a male, that from what I've seen, it's males are more guilty than females in my experience of this controlling kind of a behavior. I believe it's a throwback to previous generations, what they saw with their fathers and grandfathers. I think it's terrible. It's a terrible thing. And if you have a friend who's a little bit naive and doesn't see it, I think that at some point you should say, you know, you should think carefully about this, because if the person's controlling, now that you tell me, he wants to go here, he wants to go there, it has to be his way, always his way. I didn't see it. Because people sometimes just don't see, they don't think about it. And by just flagging the issue, you can save a disaster. I think in a nice way, it should be disclosed. But again, in a nice way, you have to be careful not to be engaged in total character assassination. Be so careful. It's a difficult balance, I agree. Is it about this question? Please. Please.
How honest do you have to be your friend if they ask you, well, what do you think of so-and-so that I'm dating?
What do you think of so-and-so that I'm dating? Do they know him or they just saw him?
No. Your friend introduces you to the person they're dating, and let's say you have serious qualms or you think there's something wrong. How honest do you have to be with her?
If they're asking you for your opinion, it should be as honest as you possibly can. But why are they asking you otherwise? They want your opinion. That's what it seems to me. If a halachic issue was resolved by an Orthodox rabbi, is there a need to disclose if the psak was no problem exists? They have to check with their own rav. It's a very good question. There can be all kinds of halachic issues, and all kinds of rabbis give all kinds of opinions. But if at the end of the day, the opinion of the first rabbi that you went to is not going to be a slam dunk with the other side's rabbi, then I think you have to resolve. You have to disclose it. Otherwise, you're asking for it. It's again a recipe for disaster. Some issue where the person's yichus is such and such and such and such. Well, they said before, whatever it happens to be. And your rabbi says, in my opinion, it's okay. But you are aware of the fact that, let's say your rabbi is on the lenient side and his rabbi is on the strict side. You know, you'll just paper it over. And you won't say anything. You'll get engaged. And it's going to come up. And the other rabbi is going to blow the whistle. And then you're going to end up with a broken engagement. Just like that. For nothing. So I think that disclosure is worthwhile in this kind of a situation.
How would you recommend factoring in opinions of family members and friends of a person one is dating, especially when the opinion is vague but not as positive as you would like? Okay. Does anybody have easy questions here? So first of all, let's say it's a sibling. You know, there's a reason why family members are pusillanimous, right? You know, you have to understand that siblings are probably the last person to necessarily give, even though we know of many sibling relationships that are extremely close. There are also sibling relationships that are not, you know, that are going to be ambivalent. And if you're picking up on that ambivalence, it doesn't necessarily mean that this person will be showing those problems with you. If it's friends, on the other hand, I would try to get I would try to get accurate feedback to the extent that you can. You know, character assassination by innuendo is not very fair. I mean, I know that people get uncomfortable, but if they seem to be hinting at a problem, it would be helpful to know it, especially if you're trying to decide whether or not to date that person or if you're in early stages. Because it really can save you some problems later on. But let me emphasize again, I've known some very successful marriages where people have been convinced that it can't work. I'm sure you've seen that all the time, right? So you have to be, you just never know how things are gonna play out. There's a well-known story I learned with Rav Palm for a number of years in Torah Hadas, for about 4 or 5 years. I was in the shir. One of my classmates tells a story about asking him about, he was a rav in a shul, and there was a marriage that had just started that this rav was convinced was doomed from the start. It was people constantly fighting, and it was an unbelievable disaster from beginning to end, and they didn't have children yet. So they went to Rav Palm, who said, and he said, am I allowed to push them to get divorced? Because once they have children, we know it's going to be a disaster. And Rav Palm, you know, immediately said, what? You have absolutely no right to do that. You never know how things are going to play out over time. And the end of the story is that they now have 12 children. I don't know how many grandchildren. And they worked it out. It was shana rishona problems. It did not end up. So you never know. And but honesty, I think, is very important when people are asking you, even though it may be uncomfortable.
Unfortunately, I think we're coming close to our close. We're going to take one last question here. I apologize for the ones we didn't get to. The 12 instruments would be great. So we'll deal with this one last question.
One,
Ellen,
is it okay? What does that say?
Is it okay to break up a relationship if she has a BlackBerry or other phone she lives in? Wow. Okay. That's an interesting question. I think the real question is one of, is she capable or is he capable of mindfulness, of really being present? Okay? If during the courting aspect of a relationship, when you're supposed to really be into each other and really be there with each other, kamayim panim el panim, you're supposed to really be with each other, if either party is not able to give you undivided attention, at least some of the time, that would have me very concerned. Because, you know, one of the core building blocks of a relationship is the ability to be together, to spend time together, and to give each other, to turn towards each other, as Dr. Gottman said when he was here last year, as being a basic building block of a good relationship. If a person can't prioritize that, and can't, in the early stages of a relationship, prioritize you by shutting that thing off, I would think that's probably at least a dark yellow flag. But what I would do before breaking it off is I would talk to the person about it. I would say, hey, I'm really concerned about this for all these reasons. Can we have some BlackBerry-free dates? If she can't, then you have to wonder how that's going to play out in marriage and in parenting. Rabbi?
I'll just end with one story. I know of a story where the young lady came to meet the future in-laws. They were about to get engaged. And she came to the house, and the boy's parents see that while she's the first time meeting his parents at his house, she's playing with texting on them, and they said to their son, break it up. And they broke it up over that. It really happened, that story.
Okay. I'd like to thank everyone again for coming. Certainly to our presenters, our sponsors. Please feel free to stick around. There's some food off to the side.
Rabbi, I shouldn't say Rabbi Willick has to run out to Sheva Bracha.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Can you give me a koala Sheva from his house? You have a smoke?
So please partake of the food. Thank you so much, everyone.
Yeah, they're good questions.
Yeah. Tough.
Thank you.